So this is session 5, May 23rd, 2006, tape 3, side 3. Right? Side 3.
Yeah.
So, they may have consciously committed suicide in a battle with another culture, but they never thought the species would die with them. Now, what's interesting is you have everybody discussing this possibility, and as McLuhan would say, that means the action has moved somewhere else. And just to project ahead, that's where you get into the Croker quadrant, where he said it already has happened. We have offed ourselves. We have disappeared. McLuhan almost implied that. Croker develops that. But back to LaRouche, we're talking about how we overdid it. The sensuality, the electrified sensuality. We also got to stress that it's not only the worst of times in human history, it's the best of times. It's unprecedented. But it's the distinguishing between what's good and what's bad is where the argument starts. I mean, for most people, it's been a glorious 30 years, especially if they were Frank Zappa fans. They heard the greatest electrified music that ever could be made, especially in concert. You know, of course, other people have other musicians they dug, but no doubt the people got great pleasure out of electrified music, despite what LaRouche says. But taking the view of looking at the effects of that hedonism, virtual hedonism, discarnate hedonism, not limited to the chemical body hedonism, that we have to take stock of.
Well, there probably are disservices to Beethoven, but LaRouche sure doesn't point them out, or maybe he doesn't see them.
Well, no, he says each musician improves on it. Mm. So, you know, Beethoven was pretty good, but he likes the 19th century guys that come after him also.
Mm-hmm. But I'm saying that style of music, I know a woman who just loves music. She has all of her life. She's got music in her heart. She's a singer, and she's just never cared about rock. You know, I mean, she's never added any to her music collection, but boy, does she, you know, these classical guys and these opera guys. So there is this, among people who are very sophisticated musically, I think there's truth in what LaRouche has to say here about Beethoven and subsequent classical artists. There's probably beauty there that is not comprehended by people who
aren't trained to appreciate it.
To appreciate it, yeah.
Now, LaRouche would say being trained to appreciate it is in the realm of the symptomology of taste, and he's not advocating that. He's not a cultural snob. He just thinks that, like this friend you're citing, she may appreciate classical music, but would she think it helps her invent new technologies, which is what LaRouche is saying? I bet you she doesn't think that.
No, she thinks it helps her expression as an artist in different media, but she's not a scientific thinking person.
Right, and LaRouche's point, this is where he integrates the arts and sciences and the split that the Gutenberg galaxy created, like LaRouche, like McLuhan advocates. He says the kind of mentation is not particular to art or science. They're both equally valid and important, and therefore he wouldn't make the distinction between art and science, even though the products are different.
Yeah.
This is the thing that LaRouche is pointing out, which is very interesting. And if you look at most people, human beings, it seems, like interaction with thought through other people. And they either numb themselves from the pain of not getting that by a lot of distractions or anesthetics in different form. But it seems that you can't stop the human being's need for this. So a healthy culture encourages this and gets rewards from it. It's hard to deny that isn't universal in humans. Like, we ourselves are engaging in a dialogue to exercise our creative mentation here, right? We enjoy doing this. You'd feel impoverished if you didn't have an opportunity to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you'd have to do it with me, but with anybody, or with some quality of rigorous thinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's humans are thought, but not the images of thought we have.
Mm-hmm.
The New Agers would say it's energy, vital energy, right?
Yeah.
I get energy from that person.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, thing, you know, we've just finished this McLuhan, this LaRouche quote, and I guess we're going to be jumping back into McLuhan, but I just wanted to look little...
We got more quotes on page 8, right?
Okay, good. So we're going to do some more of that, because there's some meat in this that I want to, that I do want to get to today, the LaRouche.
In the next quote.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go on to the next quote, just to have more LaRouche stuff, because... No, we would go. Oh yeah,
we would be jumping back to page 7 at this point.
It does go. Yeah, let's just go into a little more LaRouche, just because we haven't gotten that much.
Yeah, because this goes into something that's actually I wanted to bring up with you because it's meaningful to me.
And he talks about emotion.
Yeah, exactly. In the composition of poetry.
Okay, so this is from Beyond Psychoanalysis, 1973, page 84 of the essay.
Right. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4. Four paragraphs.
Right.
In the composition of poetry, a similar process applies. The initial conception of a great poem exists for development as a mood and a snatch of some line, usually the opening line. The conception of the whole poem exists at the initial point of elaboration, as a kaleidoscopic fabric of feeling states, a would-be gestalt of such feeling state patterns identified by that bit of thematic line, the subject of the poem.
No, this, in italics, this is the subject of the poem.
Yeah, this is the subject of the poem.
What he just said.
Yeah. The poet unfolds the poem from this, words marching in phrase groups, feeling states, and feeling state clusters, seizing upon the appropriate cathexis, which comes to the fore from unfolding association with the thematic snatch of line. The end result has ostensible symbology, metrical and other prosodic subtleties, such that from these isolable features, foolish, banal critics may indeed attempt to fashion a logical interpretation, but their effort is pathetic. The intent of the poem's elaboration was to communicate to the reader the gestalt from desire for which the elaboration began for the poet. This is more empathetically the case for great music, as we've already emphasized. The primary feeling state is love. The affect...
Love italicized.
Yeah. The affective content and form of recall of the creative process itself. The invariant human quality of the mind. To understand the dynamics of love, one begins by inquiring as to what practical expression can be given to the direct calling forth of the universal for all particular expressions of social creative activity. Every detail dissolves. The mind is dissolved into pure creative ferment. The universality of the creative act. And then the question, he says, what, comma, then, question mark. We have emphasized that thought is the demand for an act. The omission of the act for the thought is a denial of the reflected benefit of the act for the identity, and correspondingly, a diminution of the identity. The force, and then in parentheses, emotion, of thought would therefore seem to be in direct proportion to the force of reaction against the sense of identity or anxiety expressed by frustration of the...
Experienced by frustration of the act.
Experience
Let me just read that. Yeah. The force, or in brackets, emotion, of the thought would therefore seem to be in direct proportion to the force of reaction against the sense of identity or anxiety experienced by frustration of the act.
Experience substantiates such a hypothesis. Furthermore, it is demanded from the act... That the act must be in proportion to the force of the thought. Then... What is the act corresponding to the, in quotes, pure emotion of love? What, by the intensely sensuous, concretized celebration of creative sociality in general?
Is what, but the intensely sensuous, concretized celebration of creative sociality in general?
The mood must seize upon a concrete individual as its object, either a concrete universalizing social creative act as a great work of art, or sensuous loving of a concrete universal person. putting it down. No. Okay.
What'd you say? What kind of words?
Well, I'm saying
you said a bunch of, and you
meaningful words.
Yeah, meaningful words. I mean, you get to the crux of the problem. Now, as I was reading this, I was thinking two things. First of all, Sleeper's telling me that he went through, he's starting to read this book again for the fifth time or something, and he says what's really getting him this time is not the ideas in each quadrant, each author. It's the fact that if the book puts you into a state of suspended judgment because you're reading one thing saying, you know, in the McLuhan quadrant, boy, that's amazing. Then you go over and read the LaRouche thing, which might say the exact opposite or something totally different, and that's amazing. And you're left in this almost paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
He says it's the same effect as Finnegan's Wake should give you. I'm saying that, but he thought of Finnegan's Wake. The point is that this is reminds me of what we're getting here, because LaRouche is really doing a very interesting job here, but it's a kind of yoga we're doing here. This is elaborate conceptual stuff that's probably very hard to understand as you hear it, especially as you gropingly go through it for the first time spelling it out. They may not be able to get the gist of it, but it's long, and you have shorter aphoristic statements by McLuhan, two different ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so the LaRouche is really taxing a certain, seems to be a style of thinking here.
Mm-hmm.
It's literary. It's literate. It's detailed, and you got to really pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if anybody could even stand thinking about what we're reading here
mm-hmm.
nowadays, unless they were an academic or professor or something who lives in the world of books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's what I was just thinking of. Let's go into what actually LaRouche is saying here.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I wanted to bring up here, which I really appreciate about these few paragraphs, he's talking about this gestalt of feeling states and patterns that, you know, identified by a bit of thematic line or a cathexis of, you know, again, feeling states. Feeling state clusters. This subtlety of complex feeling, which he's describing here, which can be the effect on us of great art, is what I think makes us real. And this kind of sensitivity to complex feeling states is nowhere to be found in McLuhan.
Right.
And so it makes McLuhan feel empty in a way. It does make you feel a little nihilistic if you take the point of the android meme and you think that that's what you are.
That's right. No, many people found that McLuhan lacked intuition of psychological subtleties in his writings, and we'll go into what his defense to that charge is later, but. On the surface, McLuhan seems to leave that out, and you're finding LaRouche is dealing it with a very sophisticated mind.
Yeah. I mean, by the time he gets to this phrase, the primary feeling state is love, you get a sense of what he means by love, not just the generic, you know, put love on a Hallmark greeting card and send it off to somebody. You get a sense of what he means by it, and it seems like that's what makes us real.
Right, and let me say this, Scott. It is what you're saying there. I'm taking it what I was trying to say 5 minutes ago, and I was saying it's the thing that humans need.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just one particular characteristic of the person you're engaging with that you might claim you love.
Mm-hmm.
It's an energy exchange. It is some intensity.
Yeah.
That's what humans are capable of, and that's what they crave. If they don't get it,
right.
They get sick.
But more than that, he's saying it's really subtle and complex, and in order to really get down to those subtle levels of complexity which really make love sublime, you know, the artist can take you there if you're sophisticated or, as you said, trained to be able to follow.
Right. Now, here's so many questions come up from this, because you're saying he's describing it, but the act of understanding what LaRouche is pointing out is what he's trying to describe. But you engaging with these paragraphs, you're engaging an act of love, act of energizing or interacting and thinking. He's putting you into a state of mind that he's writing about.
Yeah, well, yeah, because he's using subtle and complex.
Yeah, what you're defining is that's what makes a human for real.
Yeah.
Yeah, real for humans is they're able to get the subtleties.
Yeah.
Or they're able to get that intensity which requires subtlety. That's love in italics, that interaction.
Subtlety and yet, you know, this complexity seems to be part of it.
Right. The peculiar interestingness of being human.
Mm-hmm.
The pain and the ecstasy, or the sadness and the triumph, and the overflowing gratitude that comes with the human consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
He's describing it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would say that McLuhan is saying we may be losing that subtlety, at least for Western culture's version of subtlety, because this may be a Western form of verbal, may not be so universal. But we're losing that, which is an important part of Western legacy, if we keep up with the electric onslaught. So that's the interesting thing, is that McLuhan is telling us what LaRouche is up against before he can get us back to the LaRouche level of training.
Mm-hmm.
Someone used to say to me, LaRouche has got it right, but you're saying, Bob, that as long as McLuhan is right, LaRouche can't be applied. And I say, yeah, that's true.
You agreed with it, or you're just agreeing with that, temporarily agreeing with that person?
I was agreeing with the guy saying, who understood that McLuhan is explaining why LaRouche can't be implemented.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So LaRouche tells us what we want to retrieve or to work for, and he'll maintain his mission is defining that or articulating it, while McLuhan says, well, here's the reason no one's going to hear about you, LaRouche. LaRouche, okay, you tell them and get them to make the environment so that I can be heard, but I must continue to articulate what the issues are.
Yeah.
Preserving that universe.
Yeah, maybe LaRouche is energizing the archetype in order to get it ready for being retrieved at some time in the future.
Yeah, that's what I used to say. LaRouche and them were, his gang was like a monastery. They preserved the humanism that was impossible in our time.
Yeah.
Like the Irish monks did with Christianity for a couple hundred years.
Right, yeah.
They preserved it. Like, you know, if you join their cult or just interact with them, you go to Beethoven concerts, you sit there for hours meditating on the music or paying attention. Then they relate it to political life, and it's a whole meme or a whole environment they present that you, like a hologram, you'd live in.
Yeah.
They preserve the action. They preserve the ideas in action.
Mm.
So let's go into trying to understand what we just read as it's saying here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you brought up pure emotion, you know, an hour ago. Were you thinking of this quote? Had you read ahead when we discussed what is emotion?
Yeah.
You were thinking of this?
Yeah.
And yes, now, I try to say, well, pure emotion isn't this abstract thing. It's multi-sensuous. I see LaRouche is trying to say that. He's not limiting it to whatever you thought pure emotion was, or how I interpreted an hour ago and critique your simplified version of pure emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That this paragraphs illustrate the multi-sensual, multi-leveled intensity, and it's not limited. This paragraph is showing how emotion is embedded in culture.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. And if it's a vulgar culture, then the emotions are vulgar.
Right. So you see, at a certain level, he's saying the same thing as McLuhan. This is what's interesting for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, McLuhan had to emphasize his angle, his quarter truth, so LaRouche emphasizes the other quarter truth.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see what this quarter truth is. I'm going to try to read it faster.
Okay.
In the making of poetry, he says, in the composition of poetry, a similar process applies. Similar process to what? Well, the universal law, right? Similar process to science, to creative mentation, I'm adding. So in the composition of poetry, a similar process applies. The initial conception of a great poem exists for development as a mood and a snatch of some line, usually the opening line. The conception of the whole poem exists at the initial point of elaboration as a kaleidoscopic fabric of feeling states. Sounds like a page of Finnegan's Wake. A would-be gestalt of such feeling state patterns identified by that bit of the thematic line. This is the subject of the poem. Now, I'm going to go jump down. I'm not going to read the rest of that paragraph because this goes into more of the techniques of making a poem. What's related to what it seems to be about? The primary feeling state is love, the effective content and form of recall of the creative process itself, the invariant human quality of the mind. The invariant doesn't change everywhere in humans, right? Regardless of the cultural idiosyncrasies. The invariant human quality of the mind. To understand the dynamics of love, one begins by inquiring. Imagine this, telling this to a teenager. You want to fall in love? You begin by inquiring as to what practical expression can be given to the direct calling forth of the universal for all particular expressions of social creative activity. What practical expression can bring forth the universal for all particular variations of it? Every detail dissolves. The mind is dissolved into pure creative ferment, the universality of the creative act. In other words, it gets into a problem. He's saying this is what love is. Love's a problem. Or it's a feeling state that's dealing with the problem of perceiving or thinking. What then? We have emphasized that thought is a demand for an act. The omission of the act for the thought is a denial of the reflected benefit of the act for the identity. Ah, this is really key, eh? This is where it's not just the thought. The omission of the act. So he's coming over, he's sort of trying to overcome the, not the mind-body duality, but the emotion-body duality. But also there's a kinetic bias here, eh? Maybe. He wants an act as an expression of the thought. So the thought cannot be speculative and in isolation. It has to be linked to an act. The omission of the act for the thought, if you do that, is a denial of the reflected benefit of the act for the identity. And correspondingly, a diminution of the identity. So the identity is not in cultural central sensory markings or features. The identity, the true human real, comes from an act that works out the thought. So the omission of the act for the thought is a denial of the reflected benefit of the act for the identity. You're not going to get the benefit. The force or emotion of the thought would therefore seem to be in direct proportion to the force of reaction against the sense of identity experienced by frustration of the act. Did you get that? The sense of identity that is okay. Your identity is not resolved or is not created because you don't get to act. To the degree you're frustrated and are angry that your identity does not get to manifest the act, that is a degree of emotion and actual realization of the thought. Are you getting me?
Oh, yeah. This guy's definitely better than the behavioral psychologists or whatever. You know, he's got these guys beat.
He's got Alan Watts beat in a certain way. You know what I mean? For Westerners, maybe. But, you know, he would say, no, it's not limited to Westerners. But for us, to me, from looking at it through the McLuhan angle, this may be just a Western thing, but I don't think so. I think he's trying to talk beyond cultural Western bias, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about the essence of what you say is making human real. Experience substantiates such a hypothesis. In other words, experience shows that the emotion of the thought were therefore seen to be in direct proportion to the force of reaction of getting pissed off at the situation being frustrated, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the emotion of the thought. It's like McLuhan used to say, thoughts are emotions. Most people don't think emotions are thoughts. They think there's thought and there's emotion, and they're split, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which that is the Western legacy. That's the Gutenberg effect.
Yeah.
Then he says, furthermore, it is demanded that the act must be in proportion to the force of the thought. And the force of the thought was to be in direct proportion to the force of reaction against the whole identity being frustrated because it cannot translate its thought into act.
Mm.
That's pretty good, eh? We're getting a sense of what he means here, right?
Yeah. Does that relate to that word cathexis? Is cathexis like cathartic?
Yes, but here's the technical definition. It means, just like I drew it up from the web, concentration of emotional energy on an object or idea.
Yeah.
Now, so he is saying that the emotion and the object and the act are pretty, it's like fusion. The appropriate fusion which comes to the fore from unfolding association with the thematic snatch of line. You got to be careful because he's saying that you don't get stuck in something. There's a ratio implied here, the direct proportion to the reaction of not getting where you think the thought should lead to you, or the act that the thought evokes. So he goes, then, what is the act corresponding to the pure emotion of love? What is the act corresponding to the pure emotion? Now, we sort of, this is not love italicized, which is universal energy. This is the pure emotion or the cultural idea of love, right?
Mm-hmm.
The sentimental version of love or the man-woman relationship or whoever. Then what is the act corresponding to the pure emotion of love? And he has pure emotion in quotes. What but the intensely sensuous, concretized, something like effects, concretized celebration of creative sociality in general?
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying the act of interpersonal love can be generalized to loving interaction with all of society,
mm-hmm.
which is the cliche form of what love is, your involvement with everybody. But he's not saying you just go around blandly accepting things or something.
Yeah.
Some passive...
You know the image that comes to mind? Think of an old sputtering automobile engine. It's just way... The timing's off. It's not... doesn't have the right air-to-gas ratios. The thing is barely turning over, but it's trying to keep... It's trying to get itself going. It's just sputtering.
Your car.
Huh? Yeah. But then think of if you begin to put all the tuning components into right proportions.
Yeah.
And pretty soon you've got like this finely tuned Mercedes engine that just purrs. You know, it's just working. You know, that's to me this looking at this gradient of feeling of this frustration. Because the ratios of components within you are not, you know, kind of working together. You're sort of out of tune. But as you get it, all tuned up, you start, you know, your relationship to the inner and outer universe begins to come into fruition or focus. Some of the frustration goes out of it, but there's this effort that has to be made.
I think you almost were tending to describe what I thought he didn't mean. You don't become this blissed out, totally flux and flow situation, because he's saying it ends up in a great work of art or a sensuous loving of a concrete person. So he's describing, he's talking about the act of love, interpersonal love, it seems, because he's saying the intensely sensuous, concretized celebration of creative sociality in general. The mood must seize upon a concrete individual as its object. So in other words, the thought makes you want to have an act, and the act is with some other person. That's mm-hmm. the translation of the general generosity that goes out.
Mm-hmm.
And it is manifest as a great work of art or a sensuous loving of a concrete person. You can make a great painting or great music or a great hydro dam, or you can have a great marriage.
But the frustration is always coming up, and you always have to be making an effort to work through it.
Well, that's the Zen thing, eh?
Well,
You can't non-try without trying.
Yeah, I just watched a.
I just want to say this. That sometimes when I think that way, that sounds like Alan Watson's Zen, and it then comes down as not Zen, and he's not being a Catholic here. They're saying the universal law of life.
Yeah.
Freedom and necessity. In other words, you don't have total freedom, you don't have total necessity, you're in the interval. He's describing an interval situation here, an mm-hmm. interaction between an immovable object and the irresistible force.
Yeah. Yeah.
The paradox is universal.
Right.
But then you would bring in McLuhan to say, well, the West lost the sense of paradox because it got the uniform effect of print. It recovered paradox in the multi-level electric age, therefore it started to have an identity with other non-literate societies that did have an appreciation of paradox.
Mm-hmm.
So, what were you going to say?
I just watched a reenactment of the life of Da Vinci. It was very nicely done, but, you know, I could see that this guy faced tremendous frustrations and obstacles in his life. The odds seemed to be against him in many ways, but he for him the discipline of being patient was very important, and through being patient you could then just keep working through the obstacles and the frustrations and continuing to I don't exactly know what I want to say about Da Vinci, but he seems to I recall this movie that I saw about him as I think about what we just read about LaRouche, and I know that Da Vinci was that LaRouche liked Da Vinci. he felt that Da Vinci was one of the guys who was doing it the right way. But, you know, Da Vinci was, he had this problem he was trying to work through his whole life. At the end of his life, he felt defeated because he had so many things that he wanted to, problems that he wanted to solve that he didn't get done. And so it was a little disappointing. At the end of his life, he was not really, he didn't feel completed. Because he left,
it was presented in this documentary.
Yeah, because he left so much incomplete. At the end of his life, I don't think he felt completed.
Okay, but are you getting a sense from what LaRouche is describing is that the guy, it's not a problem that he was left with that, because part of his great energy and genius was that he could handle the frustration.
Yeah, exactly. That's it.
Yeah, and that's what. But it's not a silly struggle. You're not struggling against an authority figure or something. You're taking on the task of thought and development that's been done by the greats before in all cultures, and you should enjoy that. You should jump in and tackle the same problems.
Yeah.
And you should not be discouraged by whatever the culture says that you are limited to.
Mm-hmm.
You can only be a chartered accountant. You know, the IQ test says, well, you be a chartered accountant, you be a social worker, you can be a pianist, you can be a banker. You know what I mean?
Right.
Fragmented activities. LaRouche, in this page, is giving you the sense of what genius is up against.
Yeah.
It's like an amazing statement about love. You know, they say love cannot be defined. He's attempting to define it.
Yeah.
And he's covering the whole range of activities, the personal translation of it into a relationship with someone, and also the expression of second nature products that come out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's actually mixing, if you think of a relationship with someone as more like the first nature needs in humans, and he's saying you could either go first nature or you go second nature, make a great work of art or a great new discovery or a great new invention. It's one way of expressing love. This is interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I like the way he operates in the interval,
yeah.
The way of bypassing the categories.
Yeah.
And the splits.
Yeah.
And showing you, you're not saying it's an ideal... It's a party, saying it's pretty hard to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what you're saying you got from the documentary of how much Da Vinci had to do to get what he did.
Yeah. Da Vinci understood these principles that LaRouche is talking about, the components of becoming a genius or working through to the higher hypothesis.
Yeah,
I think LaRouche is saying, you know, regardless of what nature gave you, you don't have to be a clerk because that's what the intelligence test told you. If you master the principles of genius, you can work towards becoming a genius.
Yeah, if you're put into an environment, which LaRouche said he offered, that would remind you of what potential was in you, not in a New Age or human potential thing, not a psychological potential, how you have energies that your culture hasn't even given you an opportunity to express or to develop. And so LaRouche offers a laboratory for people to explore that possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And then we call that a cult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this world is so imploded, it's so tiny, and the TV body is a cult phenomenon. Chip body is a cult phenomenon. The chip body, though, you have a lot more variety of cults to interact with than the TV body. But it's a sense of a constricted space.
Mm-hmm.
Called Nielsen ratings for the TV body. So, let's go back. I'm glad we jumped ahead. Let's go back to the first paragraph of the part I didn't finish, just to see if it makes sense after we went to the later paragraphs. The poet unfolds the poem. He said, this is the subject of the poem. The poet unfolds the poem from this. Words marching in phrase groups, feeling states and feeling state clusters. In other words, he's saying feeling and words are interchangeable. Feeling states and feeling state clusters, seizing upon the appropriate cathexis or object or idea that would crystallize it, which comes to the fore from unfolding association with the thematic snatch of line. In other words, as you work and replay the line and associate new things with it, you disperse the line into other lines. You're getting closer to the concrete goal or image you're looking for. He says, the end result has ostensible symbology, metrical and other prosodic subtleties, such that from those isolable features or different categories, From those parts, foolish, banal critics may indeed attempt to fashion a logical interpretation. They take the particulars, right?
Mm-hmm.
But their effort is pathetic. The intent of the poem's elaboration was to communicate to the reader the gestalt from desire for which the elaboration began for the poet. Okay, read that again. The intent of the poem's elaboration was to communicate to the reader the gestalt from desire for which the elaboration began for the poet. In other words, there was a desire. From that, a pattern emerges, the gestalt. This is more emphatically the case for great music, as we have already emphasized. Then he says, he has said, words marching in phrase groups, feeling states and feeling state clusters. Now he's going to go into what that means, feeling state. The primary feeling state is love. So he's saying the poem comes from desire, which is love, which is the affective, the emotional content and form of recall of the creative process itself, the invariant human quality of the mind. There's a cliche in many cultures that there's the muse for the male poet, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the muse is a love relationship in a certain way.
Yeah.
So that cliche sentimental idea that, you know, someone gets creative when some new woman comes into their life, or vice versa. A new man comes into a woman's life and inspires them to express themselves in whatever their talents indicate, or specialization indicates. That's what he's saying here. He's developing that idea. He's showing that, you know, it's not the love relationship. It's not the artwork. It is something else in humans that is expressed through either of those ways. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's love is the invisible environment, is what he's saying. To understand the dynamics of love. To understand, do you need to understand the dynamics of love? One begins by inquiring as to what practical expression can be given to the direct calling forth of the universal for all particular expressions of social creative activity. He almost has too many words here, mm-hmm. but if you really get into it and read it, you can follow it.
That is a key phrase, though. I'm not looking at it right now, but the sense of being aware of the universal and then being able to express that in the particulars.
Which can be a relationship, a sensuous loving of a concrete person.
Right.
Or some product.
But the universal, again, being this one substance, this logos, which has all intelligence enfolded within it, but it's one thing, and yet...
And you know what that is? It's that energy.
Yeah.
He's trying to describe, it's like the tip of the finger trying to touch the thing that feels touch. The old Alan Watts thing, try to see the thing that does the seeing. The energy he's saying that is universal is the very energy that the human works with and creates a byproduct. And that gets into the later LaRouche, where he talks about the discrete manifold and the concrete manifold, I think it is.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the being and the becoming. The being is always this love.
Yeah.
The becoming is the translation of it.
Yeah. Well, think of Michelangelo and the two fingers of God and man, just close enough to be able to for a spark to jump the gap.
Yeah, the gap is there, and that's another expression of the relationship of a concrete object and the thing trying to get to it.
Yeah.
It's like God is the image, the icon, the archetype of the concrete object that the human is frustratedly trying to manifest.
Yeah. God is already complete, one thing, one whole, embodies all knowledge, wisdom, blah, blah, blah. And then man is just trying to get his finger close enough for a spark of that to jump into his, you know.
Yes, but you know how the result of that effort is technology or second nature.
Yeah.
Is the artifacts are, and that in the end has progressed and unfolded to an interesting underlying universal law of extending of our senses.
Mm-hmm.
That's the pattern McLuhan points out. But LaRouche is describing the actual act of this yearning and this amazing creative acts by humans that actually unfolds the. And works towards the higher hypothesis and then the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis.
Yeah.
It's like you could almost have that image of the human and God it's parallel, it's horizontal, but you make it vertical.
Yeah.
Reaching up, yeah. You think of a hypothesis of a higher hypothesis. Or maybe reaching down.
The thing that distinguishes LaRouche and McLuhan in my mind is that LaRouche dealing with the stuff of human nature and these complex feeling states, and McLuhan dealing with how technology mirrors human beings, the human sensorium.
Yeah.
But that thing that mirrors the human sensorium doesn't have complex feeling states. It doesn't. It misses the very. It's missing the very essential thing that makes us human.
Right. And to the degree you're right about McLuhan in producing that effect, we could say he's a satirist in the Wyndham Lewis tradition of a cold, almost inhuman satirist.
Mm-hmm.
He's throwing cold water in our face to wake us up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it doesn't appear to involve with human emotion.
Mm-hmm.
But McLuhan's doing that to get people back into the LaRouche awareness. But see, what do we create today? There's nothing but creativity today in all kinds of forms. So this is where LaRouche, you know, becomes silly. He's actually asking, saying we've got to do this to become creative. You've got nothing but creative if you think of creativity as just expressing yourself.
No, I think we have nothing but formats, you know, templated structures for producing new, quote-unquote, creative products. You know, rock becomes commercialized. It becomes formulated ways of producing movies, formulated ways of stamping out new technology.
Okay, I would say that's the TV body disservice. In the chip body, there are people right now editing images that are never going to be sold, but are creating little multimedia poems themselves, or they're on news groups communicating back and forth, responding in all kinds of funny, tragic, banal ways. I'm thinking at this point of communication as the creative act. Any form of communication. There's the TV body kind that became formulaic, and that's still going on, but the chip body has got all kinds of stuff going on. For example, what we're doing is made possible by the chip body.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
And we're creating something within this little tube here. So it's not formulaic.
Yeah.
So there's a lot more opportunities as we got into the digital idea to do this, or the digital environment.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why, you know, LaRouche becomes anemic on the sidelines, because he's talking about something that most humans, no, not most humans, a lot of humans in North America think they're engaging in, even though it looks trivial. And often they're left after it, well, what did I waste an hour on, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But they couldn't stop from participating. So now we start flipping over to myth as participation, whereas LaRouche's myth is thought, is creative involvement with something to create. He's saying we got to create a new form of energy, and I assign this to everybody. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
He's telling everybody, he runs into it, you get into the labs, find it, study it in whatever form you find it approachable to. We need to make new inventions. The guy says, no, that I got some email to answer.
Right.
He would say, forget the email.
Yeah.
Start thinking on a serious level. To me, it sounds silly what he's saying. But at the other sense, the other way, other end, you cannot deny the importance of what we just read.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you read this and try to understand it, you feel like this guy is saying something that hasn't been said before.
Yeah.
In such a way.
Yeah. Yeah, you really have to peel away the layers of what you've referred to as the comic book image manifest in the media or promoted in the media about LaRouche.
The TV body.
Yeah, because I've had, although I've been interested in LaRouche because you keep pointing out that he's an interesting guy, I haven't really appreciated him until now, because
until
I've been
today or just the past few weeks reading this.
Yeah, the past few weeks reading this. Yeah,
yeah.
Because his comic book media TV image has always been sort of the first place I go to in my mind when I think about him, because that's what most people are exposed to.
And here's this guy that is big evil demon, and you're reading, my God, this guy has actually described love in the most interesting way, to the point you brought it up at the beginning of our sessions tonight. Right. So that's so he communicated something to you.
Yeah, he's becoming a really interesting guy.
Yeah.
And I don't feel like he's, I don't know. You know, when I first read about his, you know, ideas about, well, you have to be into provincial classical music, otherwise you're just nobody. I mean, that sounds like, oh, this guy's a stick in the mud.
Yeah.
But starting to change my views.
Right, and so it's, you know, it's to my credit finding these quotes and putting them down.
Yeah.
Because I got a good handle on this stuff years ago, and I said, okay, if I want to replay the greatest hits of LaRouche, these are the quotes I would pick.
Mm-hmm.
And you're proof that it's working.
Yeah. Yeah. And you got to be 75 years old to be able to have found all this stuff on your own and recognized it when you saw it.
84 years old, yes.
Hey, 84,
yeah,
sorry.
A long time to
yeah.
be able to do all this.
Right.
To present all these different quadrants.
Yeah, because I can't think of an educational institution on the planet that would give somebody a rich enough appreciation.